Hey, serious privacy enthusiasts. Ready to ace your AI data privacy game?
Oh, you bet, Kay. Dive into the world of TrustArc's Nemity Research, your go-to for staying on top of regulatory developments in AI and privacy.
Seriously, Nemity Research maintains a massive privacy and regulatory database featuring expert guidance and analysis from legal and privacy pros.
So save time on privacy research, cut your compliance timeline, and reduce costs with Nemity Research.
Get your regulatory research and insights at your fingertips with a free trial.
So get ahead in privacy compliance and start that free trial today. Go to trustarc.com/nimity-free-trial.
You're listening to Serious Privacy by TrustArc. Please welcome our hosts, Paul Breitbarth and Kay Royal.
Both in the US and the European Union, the dust from the Schrems II decision on 16 July is slowly settling. But we are just at the beginning of understanding all the consequences of the verdict of the EU Court of Justice. Don't worry, also in the coming weeks, we've got you covered. Serious Privacy will keep you posted on important developments and views, starting with the conversation of our guest of today. A teacher and an educator in both privacy and data security legislation, an internationally known expert and prolific writer of books, articles on these topics must have a view of what happens next in transatlantic data relations. And what are his views about the CPRA, which suddenly receives opposition from a coalition led by the ACLU and small business associations? You'll hear all about it in today's episode. My name is Paul Breitbarth.
And I'm Kay Royal, and welcome to Serious Privacy. I am very excited for the guest that we have today, Professor Dan Solov, and I think he's heard me tell this story once before. So before I get to the unexpected question, I'm going to tell the quick story of how I met Dan. So I've been an aficionado of privacy for a very, very long time. And of course, all the textbooks on privacy are authored by Dan Solov. I got an email one day, this was probably back in 2012, and it was from Professor Dan Solov. And I saw the name and I was like, oh my gosh, is that the Dan Solov? And it was. He had written me, he had started a company called Teach Privacy, and we can talk about that in a little bit here. And he was reaching out to me because I had worked in education, medical, tech, was in privacy, was in different verticals, and he just wanted to get my perspective on some of the trainings that he had rolled out, and I worked with him for a few years, intermittently reviewing some here and there. And I have to tell you, when I realized it really was him, I stood up from my chair and did a little happy dance, Fortnite! Did a little happy dance because my privacy hero had reached out to me. And this was just so thrilling. So if you have a hero, you know what I mean. When you get contacted by that person unexpectedly or you get to meet them, it's just a real happy moment. So I'll never forget that. Dan probably won't either because I won't let him. So Dan, it is now time for our unexpected question. And today I was going to go with what's a topic your board talking about, but I'm afraid what the answer may be. So instead, we're going to use, if you had to move to a new city, where would you move to?
Wow, that's actually a tough one these days.
Non-COVID world.
I'm just working on getting out of the house, let alone moving somewhere. That's a tough one. There are many really exciting cities. I always love the Bay Area. I think that's a really fun place. So I definitely would enjoy that. London would be a lot of fun, so I could see myself there. Those are probably the two places that I think are the most intriguing. But these days, at this point, I'll settle for a breath of fresh air in my backyard.
Love it. And you're absolutely right. What about you, Paul?
Oh, I'd move to Stockholm.
There, no doubt.
Easy choice. No doubt. No, there are so many cities across Europe and around the world that I love, but for livability, Stockholm is very high on my list, and I absolutely fell in love with Sweden in recent years. I like the people, I like the nature and all the possibilities that you have just exploring out of Stockholm, and just to live on one of the many islands in the archipelago to just enjoy life there. Yeah, that sounds like a good thing.
Considering your background is always water, I guess I would never have known that you like water and beaches. For me,
oh yes, water always needs to be close to me.
For me, it would be Research Triangle Park, United States. I don't know why. I don't really have a desire to move back to the, and I'm doing air quotes here, South. But Research Triangle Park, which has Raleigh, Durham, and Chapel Hill, it has North Carolina State University, Duke, and UNC, respectively. It, for some reason, it's just a place that has always appealed to me. I'm not even sure I've ever visited it, but it's a place that I would love to live. It, I don't know why. There you go. I can't say there's anything in particular about it that draws me, but that's my place. So with that, Paul, do you have something you want to start out asking Dan about to kick us off?
Well, of course. I mean, there's only been one topic on my mind since we last recorded the podcast, and that is the Schrems 2 decision. No surprise there. But I'm actually very curious what Professor Solov makes of the decision.
What Schrems? No, I'm just kidding. So obviously this is big news. I actually am very steeped in Schrems because I have just finished editing it for my casebook.
Oh, no.
Where Paul and I took a crack at it, and I must say it is really hard to edit this opinion. It is written in such a dense and clunky way. I'm actually being kind to the writing.
Yes, I think you are.
It really was quite a bear to whittle it down to, you know, really about, you know, a tenth its size. But having done that, I definitely have some thoughts about Schrems. I think that, you know, the court really stuck to its principles. I had thought that the line of reasoning of the court in Schrems 1, that, you know, the U.S. surveillance law was not adequate, that logic applied to both the standard contractual clauses and BCRs. But I thought that, you know, the pragmatic side of the court would find some way out, because that would mean that data would have trouble being transferred to a lot of countries around the world, including the U.S., and there isn't an easy solution to this problem. But the court, I think, stuck to its principles. It struck down Privacy Shield, and I think that part of the decision makes a lot of sense based on the court's reasoning. Privacy Shield really didn't address some of the more thorny issues that created some of the problems in the first place with regard to the EU and US surveillance law. The standard contractual clauses part, I think, is the more difficult part of the opinion. And there the court left open a window. So at first glance, you'd see the headline, you know, standard contractual clauses survive. And that's sort of the quick headline in the case. But they survive, but not really that much. The court basically said that unless there is some kind of measure that is put in place, the standard contractual clauses will not work.
Right.
And ultimately, too, that this could apply to BCRs as well. So people who have BCRs and think that they're safe, they're not safe. Nobody is safe. Something needs to be done. And I think that there are really only two ways that I can think, or actually three ways that I can think data can be transferred now. One is if the U.S. changes its approach in the law and comes up with a new type of Privacy Shield arrangement. That's going to be very hard, because the things that the court wants in U.S. surveillance law are things that, you know, generally our legal system has really struggled with providing. And we have some very bad Supreme Court decisions, some very bad surveillance law in the United States. I actually agree with the EU court that, you know, our law is pretty awful.
Yeah.
And we have a lot of problems with it. And I think they're right in how bad our law is. And the U.S. response, which I think was largely, well, EU, you know, law of a lot of your member states is bad, too, is not really an answer. Either we fix our law or they're not going to transfer the data. It's that clear.
It is very true, though.
Yeah, and so then
it's the, not. It is a true statement, right. But also EU surveillance laws are pretty bad.
That's right, but I think our laws have some more avenues of recourse, and ultimately too, for various political reasons, the GDPR and the EU stays away from its own law. This is really about requirements for transferring outside of the EU, and so they can say, look, this is the standard that we would like you to meet, and if you don't meet the standard, it doesn't matter whether we meet the standard, that's the standard. And they're basically, it said, we need a system where people can challenge the law and make challenges on the surveillance. And unfortunately, because of, I think, a very poor Supreme Court decision in Clapper versus Amnesty International, people can't make a challenge, even if there's a potential violation of their constitutional rights, of their Fourth Amendment rights. That to me is a big problem. I mean, it's an absurd decision in Clapper, I think, that the government put people under surveillance, wouldn't tell them if they're under surveillance. They had very good reason to believe that they were under surveillance. They were trying to take measures to protect themselves. And the court said, you don't have standing. You can't even bring a claim and even try to have us adjudicate whether this is a violation of the Fourth Amendment, because we won't even let you get there. Because the government won't tell you if you're under surveillance or not. And so the government says, great, we can escape Fourth Amendment scrutiny for what we're doing by just keeping it secret from you. And so I think that is pretty offensive to the EU system, and at least to this court, that there really would be no recourse for people. And then, too, there's a lot of talk. It's not that we engage in a lot of surveillance. It's that the surveillance is not lawful,
right?
In that there's no real protections around the data, no limit to the retention of the data, no real meaningful standards for reviewing the surveillance. I mean, we have standards, but they're kind of they're not very meaningful standards. So we really, I think that's part of the problem. It's not that we're doing a lot of surveillance. It's that the law that we have is not really providing much protection at all, and very little recourse for anyone to challenge this based on the Constitution or otherwise. So that's the problem. And I think that if we fixed our law, which I think it's a good opportunity to do, that's one way, but I don't see that happening anytime soon. It would take, I think the Supreme Court would need to rethink some poor decisions it's made, and I don't think it'll do that. Or Congress would need to create a law to provide for people to have a right to challenge things and to create better protections. And I'm not sure that's going to happen. So that avenue is out. So then the other avenues to companies are, I see two choices. One is encrypt everything so that even when it's transferred, there's just no way that intelligence agencies can get to this information. So that's option A. Option B is there any other way that people could make the transfer of data, either get consent of everybody or find some other exception that would allow for the data transfer to take place? And that's sort of the part of the equation I don't fully know yet, is there any other way or other conditions that are allowable for the transfer of data, perhaps with people's consent, that would allow for it. So I basically think those are going to be our choices, either encrypt or, find this other way, or just somehow hope that the U.S. comes up with a better system for its laws regarding surveillance.
I do think that we'll have to hope for the US legal update, because also consent from the EU perspective is not likely to work, since according to the data protection authorities, the derogations, of which consent is one, can only be used for one-off transfers and for nothing that is either continuous or structural or massive. So for commercial contracts, that would already not work. So consent is out too, which makes it very hard. And I do believe that the adequacy requirement that the EU have is very severe, especially in relation to third countries, and especially with regard to surveillance legislation. But I also don't think that there is any alternative possible. I've spent the past years thinking quite regularly, is there any alternative to adequacy? But if you look back at 40 years of case law here in the European Union, both from the court in Luxembourg, but also from the Court of Human Rights in Strasbourg, it seems that there is so much case law already on how interferences into fundamental rights should work and could work, that I don't see any realistic alternative but the third country indeed putting those safeguards in place that the court now has said are needed.
Right.
Yeah, I think your take is exactly correct. You know, consent will be very, very difficult. And so, you know, is there any way to come up with something to make that work effectively? I'm not sure. The other option, the most feasible option then, is to encrypt. That's the one thing I can think of that could work, is if, you know, any transfer of data is encrypted and before it's sent over, so that therefore it cannot be intercepted or obtained by the government.
Yeah, very, very interesting. So I know SHRMS is top of mind for just about everyone, but I have to say for myself, the CCPA or the CPRA that is now going to be on the ballot is also top of mind for people. Although I have to say, I could keep talking SHRMS for just about another few weeks in order to understand it. And I'm very, very interested in seeing.
We will, Kay. Don't worry.
I have a feeling we will. And I'm very excited to see how you break it down in your textbook. That's going to be fascinating to see how you can present that. Because, yeah, how law students can absorb privacy is law is very interesting. But moving on to CPRA. So there was this Twitter campaign that came out by the ACLU of California posting say no or stop Prop 24. They don't really give a lot of reasons in here as to why, but the one image I have is stop Prop 24. It rolls back privacy rights. It lets tech companies upload your confidential data the minute you travel out of California with a device. I have absolutely no idea where that's coming from in the CPRA. Any insight to that, Dan, as to why they might think that it's rolling back privacy rights?
I really don't fully understand
either
what the ACLU's businesses here exactly. And I'm confused about this for a bunch of things. First of all, it's just weird to roll out, you know, this whole thing in a bunch of tweets. I mean,
right.
I don't know if they're channeling President Trump or what they're trying to do, but you know, I don't think you make good policy with a tweet. Secondly, I think that, you know, I'm not sure, this is typically not something the ACLU does when a law, you know, infringes on free speech or, you know, create certain major problems. I can think that, you know, the ACLU would jump in there. But this seems to be more about, you know, this law isn't really good policy. It's not clear it would, I don't think it's going to diminish rights or somehow give companies the ability to track devices that they don't already have. So I'm not quite understanding how this law, how the ballot initiative creates all these problems that wouldn't already exist without the ballot initiative. I think one could certainly say, you know, is this going to be effective? Is this the solution to people's privacy problems? Is this really enough? And I actually think no. I think that, you know, the CCPA and the ballot initiative are not quite the approach I would recommend to protecting privacy. I think that there are certain things in them that are good and certain things that are a lot of busy work, some things that I think create some security issues. So there's a bunch of things in there, both the original CCPA and then the initiative that, you know, are good. There are some things that are not so good. And there are a number of things, missed opportunities where there could be a much stronger, better approach to regulating privacy. I mean, if the goal is, you know, how do we give people meaningful privacy protection? I wish that the CCPA and this new Ballied initiative had delved more into some of the literature.
Right.
There are a lot of really thoughtful law review articles and other pieces put out by scholars and advocates and others that have really thought through a lot of this stuff. And unfortunately, I just don't see that reflected in the CCPA or the CPRA. And that's what's unfortunate to me, is that there's a lot of advice out there that I think shows why some of these things are just not going to work very well, not going to achieve the intended goals. Because ultimately, I mean, here's just one example with the CCPA. The idea is, okay, we're going to help people protect their privacy. And so to do that, they give people a privacy right to obtain from organizations that collect information about them. They can obtain a list of all the pieces of data that were collected about them in the past 12 months. And then they have a right to opt out of that sale of that data to third parties. But the problem with this is, unless you know what companies have the information about you, how are you going to know who to ask for?
Right.
And then beyond that, and there are a lot of companies that have our data we don't even know about. And then beyond that, there are thousands of companies that are gathering people's data. So you're going to go and make this request for thousands of companies, and you're going to do it constantly to see what data they have about you, and then you're somehow supposed to get all this stuff, which could probably, you know, fill your house if you printed it all out. And so then you get all this data, which is just going to be a big data dump. And okay, what does it mean? It's not meaningful unless you know how every piece of information is being used, what it's combined with.
Right.
Otherwise, it's just a list of stuff, and you have no implication about, well, is this a problematic sale or use, or is it not? Well, you don't know. So I can't make a meaningful decision about it. But let's say I go and get it all and do the scavenger hunt for it. That's going to take years to do. And then I have to opt out of it all. So again, it's going to take forever. Who is going to manage this except a crazy person? Really, people are not going to do this. So we create like a whole big thing to create the illusion that people have control over this, when they have when what we're providing them is not real meaningful understanding of what's going on, or a really meaningful way to carry it out efficiently. So to me, it just looks pretty, costs a lot, but ultimately is hollow.
And I think that's exactly one of the criticisms of the ACLU for both CCPA, but also maybe especially for CPRA, that it doubles down on the harmful idea, I quote from the tweets, that people should carry the burden of protecting their own privacy by filling out a bunch of forms and hoping companies do as they ask. But if I look at CPRA, what could, in my view at least, with the European perspective, make a difference is the new enforcement agency that would be created. Is that something that you are supportive of?
I mean, I'm generally always supportive of enforcement. So I do like enforcement. I think that laws could always use stronger enforcement, because a lot of times, you know, the enforcement arm for a lot of privacy regulation tends to be understaffed and under-resourced. They only go after a few folks, and then the penalties are often not as bad as the infraction. So, you know, it's ultimately... Mm-hmm. I always dislike enforcement where companies are better off for having broken the law and then, you know, paying the speeding ticket, rather than, I think that the penalties have to make the companies worse off,
right,
than they were. Not even, because the odds of getting caught are still low. So, you know, most companies will get away with it. So you have to have penalties that are going to be more severe, so that there's a significant risk of really being set back more than you could get had you skirted the law. And I think that, you know, right now in a lot of enforcement, it's not quite there yet, and it needs to get there if we're really going to have, you know, companies following the law more consistently.
Agreed. And that was exactly where I was going to go, Paul, is it seems like one of the best things in the CPRA is establishing the agency. And I really hope if it does pass, that that helps drive other state laws to establish agencies, or more importantly, encourages the United States itself to establish an agency, which if we had one that was specifically focused on consumer privacy and not just as part of its duties, that maybe that would also help drive that international data transfer conversation forward as well, if it actually has teeth and authority.
I must beg to differ a little on that, because I actually like what the FTC does. I think the FTC is actually doing a pretty good job.
Oh, I think they're doing a fantastic job. Don't get me wrong there. I think we just need to take their work and explode it, not explode it in a bad way, make it larger and more powerful.
Well, I totally agree with that, but I would keep it with the FTC because, you know, the FTC has a couple advantages. One, it's been around forever. It's been around for 100 plus years. It generally remained fairly insulated from political influence for a long time. For most of the time, I mean, first of all, it's bipartisan. You know, you cannot have more than 3 out of the 5 commissioners of any one party. And so even Trump appointed, you know, 2 fairly liberal Democrats to be commissioners who are very, you know, strongly pro-privacy.
Right.
And I think generally you have, I think, a pretty good consensus when it comes to the FTC commissioners on privacy issues. There's disagreements, but what's surprising to me is that, you know, over the course of the FTC's history, you really don't see stunning reversals or suddenly, right, you know, changing to a whole different perspective on privacy. Also, I think, and I'm not sure if the grass is greener with a different agency that might not be as insulated from the politics of a different presidential administration. So you have one presidential administration, and then suddenly the FTC is pro-privacy, and then the next administration, they're suddenly, you know, pulling back on everything they did. We really don't want that. And I think the FTC has done a good job of staying, as agencies go, you know, out of the political fray. And I look at, you know, what's happening to the EPA and the Department of Education and the FCC, and how these agencies pretty much are now, you know, just doing whatever the bidding is of the presidential administration. And so they've radically changed a lot of their policies in light of that. And the FTC has been spared that.
Right.
So that's why I think that, you know, there are good reasons to stick with them, but I do agree wholeheartedly that they need more resources. We need to give them a lot more muscle, and I think even more insulation. I mean, the one instance where they got a lot of pushback, had to back down, was when Congress attacked them over KidVid. Mm. And that incident, I think, you know, still smarts with the, it still hurts.
Right.
And they still live in fear of that, of Congress jumping in and attacking them.
Which we should all fear.
Yeah.
To be honest.
It's certainly better than, you know, a presidential administration by, you know, order of one person, you know, can essentially radically change what an agency does.
Right.
So at least it would take, you know, I'd much rather face Congress than, you know, have it be, you know, controlled
by the whims
by
of
the
one person. Right. Now, I do find it interesting that you mentioned the FCC, because you're right. The FCC has lost a lot of its oomph, I guess is the most technical term I can come up with their enforcement on privacy, because I still remember years ago at IAPP when I believe it was it Edith Ramirez was interviewing someone from both the FCC and the FTC about privacy during a IAPP keynote, and it was during the summit in the spring. I believe it was 2015, 2016, and Travis LeBlanc was the representative from the FCC there, and I immediately became a big fan of Travis LeBlanc, because he started out, there was nothing dry about him whatsoever, started out by saying, is it the FCC or the FTC that's better at enforcing privacy?
it's not Superman versus Batman. We're all controlling crime. And loved it. But now here we are 4 or 5 years later, and we're not seeing, you know, hardly anything out of the FCC anymore.
Yeah, I think there are two reasons for that. One is Travis LeBlanc is really wonderful, and he came to the FCC, which had been rather sleepy when it came to privacy and security. You really hadn't seen a lot of action and focus on those issues before Travis began at the FTC. And he really made those issues, really put them on the front burner with approaches to push a number of cases. He was very powerful on enforcement, got huge enforcement for $100 million plus enforcement actions. And so really put this on the map. And I thought built up a very impressive jurisprudence of enforcement actions that established much better privacy and security. And so I think his tenure was wonderful. When he left, I think a lot of that initiative just
left with him.
Kind of, it just became dusty and no one really kept it going. And then on top of that, the new administration proceeded to even further push back the FTC, I'm sorry, the FCC by rolling back those rules that the FCC had established for privacy. And so just further made it, you pushed it out of this area. So right now I think that, we really are not seeing anything out of the FCC that I am aware of on privacy and security. That might change with a different administration because Travis at least set the groundwork, the foundation, the theories, the existing enforcement actions are already there. And I think that can be built upon when, someone else comes in and wants to pick up the torch again. It's a lot easier to pick it up than to build it anew.
Right. True. At least it's words that they've heard before.
Exactly.
Yeah. That would be interesting. Well, we don't have very much left on the show. And with all of your, and I do know, and Paul, you may have a last question as well, so don't let me usurp you here. But Dan, I'm really interested in, you are the name in privacy scholarship, and along with Paul Schwartz. Don't ever let me demean Paul at all. He is fantastic. But with your experience in looking at privacy law and how it's developed and changed, I'd love to have your perspective on, did you have expectations for privacy and were those met? Do you have expectations now from privacy that you're afraid it's going down a certain path or a way that you would like to see? I'd just love to hear your thoughts on the privacy field and where you see it going or where you thought it might go that it did not.
Yeah, well, I've been following privacy since the late 90s, so quite a long time. And I must say, in some ways, it's developed way beyond my expectations. The field is much, much larger. When I started, there was no IAPP. I could count the number of chief privacy officers on one hand. There were hardly any privacy notices. I actually have read every article and book on privacy. It wasn't hard. There weren't that many.
That's certainly changed.
Yeah. I remember, if there was a news story on privacy in a week, I'd be like, oh my gosh, an article written in the news about a privacy issue.
Right. And now there's movies about privacy.
You can't even, there's no way to keep up. It's so vast. So the growth of the field has been tremendous. I think there are a lot of new laws and some really good ones. The GDPR is great. And I think there are others that are, we've made a lot of progress.
Right.
I think certainly where things are now versus where they were, let's say go back 20 years, it's tremendous. Like if you were writing a comprehensive privacy law back in 2000, there really wasn't much going on. No one would really think, oh, we're going to put in a right to deletion.
Right.
No one would think we're going to put in data breach notification. No one would think of putting in data portability. There are so many components now that would almost be a must have or a given in a privacy law that people wouldn't have even thought of 20 years ago. So we've made progress. That said, I think that a lot more progress still needs to be made. I think that, you know, privacy law is still largely stuck on something I call privacy self-management, which is the idea that if we just give people, you know, more notice about what companies are doing with their data, and then just throw a few rights with people about, okay, you can access it, you can correct a couple things, and you can opt out of a couple things, or even to opt into a couple of things, I'm not sure that really is an effective approach. So we do need to think about how do we create more meaningful privacy regulation? How do we turn the corner on this and really create something that is more powerful? And I think that that's where I think we've struggled, and the law has not developed enough. So that, you know, I'm happy with the amount of legal development, and I certainly think the law is a lot better, but I still think that it's far from what I would call effective. And that is where I think we still need to go. But what's the optimist in me says, you know, look at how much was accomplished in the last 20 to 25 years. Look at how many laws were passed. Look at how much attention is in this field now. Look at how many people are thinking about this and writing about this, and how many privacy officers there are. And a lot of the privacy officers are great people inside companies really trying to do the right thing. It's like, all that's really great. But I still think that the tools we have need more maturity. And I still think we have a long way to go. So the pessimist in me says, well, we've got a mountain to climb.
Nice.
You mentioned that when you started in privacy, you were able to read every single article that came out. And I sometimes have the idea, the illusionary idea, I should say, that I want to read everything that comes out. So my reading list on privacy articles is longer than I would probably ever have the time to read. One of the things that I did read was your latest paper for the GW Legal Studies Research on the myth of the privacy paradox. And in wrap up, just briefly, people can read the article, we'll link to it. But in the article, you write, among many other things, that people's behavior generally demonstrates that they are failing to protect their own privacy and are readily sharing their personal data. But also that the mere fact that people make a trade-off doesn't mean that the trade-off is fair, legitimate, or justifiable. Do we also need to do more to educate people themselves about what they should do? Or is that an illusion? And should we just, from the government perspective, try and protect them to the best of our abilities?
Well, I think both. I wouldn't say don't educate people, but I feel that even being educated, it's still hard to make privacy risk decisions for a consumer.
Right.
And that's what I wanted to get at with the paper, because a lot of times the answer is, well, just tell them more information, educate them more. Mm-hmm. If consumers just understood the risks, then they wouldn't use these devices and they wouldn't make privacy trade-offs. Well, you know, I don't buy that. You know, I know the risks, and yet I still use a smartphone.
I was going to say, I make trade-offs.
I do too.
Yeah. And I don't totally know the risk of what is the risk of my using a smart doorbell. I know the risks, some of the risks, but ultimately don't. It's very hard to make the risk decision, and I'll still use it, even though I'm not happy with, you know, some of the risks I'm assuming. I, you know, a lot of devices and use a lot of technology that I think carries risks. Some of the risks are very hard to figure out. You know, like, what is the risk of putting up a picture of your child on Facebook?
Right.
You know, it's very hard to calculate that. What is the risk that, you know, how data is going to be used in the future? Well, to know that, I need to know what is going to happen in the future. How could the data be used? Who would be accessing it for what reason? How will the data be combined with other pieces
right.
of data? And that I'll never be able to find out all that. And what are the algorithms going to do?
Right. So what's inside the black box that mm-hmm. nobody seems to know?
So basically, give me the next, you know, 30 years worth of algorithms. Tell me what algorithms are going to look like, you know, 10 years from now. And then tell me what data is going to be fed into those algorithms and what decisions are going to be made based on the data in those algorithms. The bottom line is, I can't possibly make a meaningful risk calculation now. So that's why I think that ultimately the second thing you mentioned beyond educating, that we need, you know, laws that establish clear boundaries, laws that really, you know, look out for people. And we can't escape from that substantive regulation. I know it sounds paternalistic, but ultimately, you know, just like, for instance, I like the idea that I can buy milk at the supermarket and I can buy vegetables and fruits and meats and everything else. And I know that what's in my fridge is not going to kill me. That I don't have to go and research, like, is this farm safe? Is this cow safe? Is this whatever safe? And research the brands and send out like a team of expert scientists and to study it. Someone's done that for me.
Yeah, there's a threshold they had to pass.
Exactly. And that someone's on it. Like, they're looking at the food safety and the experts are making sure that, you know, things are, now they don't always do a good job of it for sure, but I don't have to learn like what the acceptable levels of arsenic should be in my food and what's safe and not, and how many bee parts should be in my honey. All I want to do is just be able to buy the product and enjoy it and know that, you know, someone with has really looked at this. It has my back and is looking out for this, because the consumer don't have, and privacy is the same way. They don't have time to study all this and figure all this out.
Right.
So knowing there are some clear boundaries would help a lot. And I think the law needs to take that direction.
Let's hope that we'll get there. And with that, we wrap up another episode of Serious Privacy. If you like our series, please do tell your friends and colleagues about us as well. Subscribe to Serious Privacy in your favorite podcast application. And should you have any questions or suggestions, please reach out to us via seriousprivacy@trustark.com or via Twitter at podcastprivacy. You will find Kay on Twitter as Heart of Privacy and myself as Europol B. Thank you again for listening to Serious Privacy, and until our next episode, goodbye.
Bye, y'all.
That was Serious Privacy.
Hey, listeners. Looking to navigate the realm of responsible AI data privacy governance? Well, look no further.
Absolutely. TrustArc is paving the way, offering a complete approach to managing privacy risks in the world of AI.
TrustArc allows organizations to confidently use AI with personal or sensitive data, moving forward efficiently and cost-effectively.
And here's the kicker. Protect your company and data with TrustArc's privacy-driven compliance software.
Because their deep automation streamlines data privacy governance, cutting your time to compliance with automated data mapping, risk assessments, and regulatory reporting.
TrustArc's enhancements go way beyond that, helping organizations understand AI better and align cross-functionally on data governance, privacy, and security.
Plus, they provide guidance on privacy governance for AI and how to mitigate risks using frameworks like NIST AI, OECD AI, and the NIMACY Privacy Management Accountability Framework.
If you're aiming for compliance excellence, check out Privacy Central, seriously one of my best parts. It uses automation and privacy expertise to understand your requirements, build and manage your privacy program with ease.
Oh, I agree. Privacy Central is your go-to to measure your progress toward responsible AI data compliance.
Stay ahead with TrustArc's Privacy Central. Visit TrustArc.com now. Ask me and Paul if you have any questions.